From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 7th day of July 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. And a bit later in the program, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois. Along the way, I'll update you on the happenings in Washington, D.C. and the agricultural news. And as we close out our time together, we'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast with Mike Tenura. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. And it all happens right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, futures finished lower, sharply lower, in fact, in the bean pit, down 52 cents today at $10.54 and a quarter in the July, November at 48 and a half, lower, $10.24 and three quarters, the settlement price. January down 47 and a quarter, and July beans down 32 and a half. They finished at $9.97 and a quarter. Corn futures were down a quarter at $3.35 and a half in the lead option July. December, the harvest month, up a quarter at $3.48 and a half. July wheat 3 and three quarters lower at $4.12. The hard red July at $3.96 and a half, down 4 cents. Live cattle futures in the August, $1.17 and a half lower at $111.62 and a half. Feeder cattle down $1.42 and a half at $143.15. And the lean hogs for the day at $81.15, 42 and a half cents lower. Dan Zwicker of Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas now joins us to take up what's happened in Chicago. Kind of a rough day there in Chicago. Tell me about the bean pit, please, Dan.
Well, I think we're still seeing the liquidation of that huge hedge fund position or fund position in soybeans. Now, we'll have to see how much open interest came out of it today. I think if what came out of it, which I think could have come out of it, we might be approaching the open interest levels that we were right at the start of this big move up in soybeans, which was, you know, back around first part of March. So we did break through some key areas. I thought yesterday's action was kind of indicative that maybe beans were going to try to hold, or at least the front end months, we're going to try to hold this 38% retracement level, but today's big decline, that melted down. So I guess the next retracement point that we'll be looking at is going to be at a 50% level or so. Your new crop months had already had kind of broken through the 38% retracement level, but it was still, if beans would have held today, that still would have been, you know, kind of considered a 38%. Maybe it was going to stabilize. But given the weather pattern and the prospects of non-threatening weather, at least what we see in the near term, it's just going to be very difficult to hold the bean market up with the type of long position that the funds had accumulated here during, you know, the spring and early summer months.
And as your expectations look forward, what do you see for the bean pit then?
Well, I think time-wise, and this is tricky, but time-wise, I do think beans are sinking into a window here where we could have a meaningful 18-week cycle low. Beans have a tendency to follow an 8 to 9 week cycle pattern, or two of those that makes up kind of like a 16 to 18 week type cycle. And we're 18 weeks out from that March low. We're 9 weeks out from the setback we had. I forget, I don't have a chart in front of me, but we're sinking into a period here time-wise that the bean market could, once we get this liquidation out of the way, it could turn into an 18-week cycle low, and then the market then would be ready to regroup then for some kind of recovery rally, depending upon how the fundamentals plan out. I do know that one observation over the years, I've not only followed commodity cycles, I've followed weather cycles, and weather is, you know, each season has 12 weeks in it, and that 12 weeks can kind of be divided up into 4 3-week blocks. The weather pattern here shifted there around the first day of summer, and that takes you into about mid-July. So mid-July, around July 15th, give or take a few days, you could be in for a weather pattern shift. I'm not saying there's one going to occur, but the window will be open for a weather pattern shift at that point. And that might then, you know, depending upon how it plays out, could give us a reason that the market would stabilize, give us some kind of recovery rally, and put us in a little different shed of light compared to where we're at this past week, which has been basically, I think, pulling the plug on the La Nina drought of 16. I mean, there was obviously an element of that, the drought 16 market built into this during the month of May and early June. And that weather pattern that a lot of weather people were calling for just never materialized. In fact, it basically, you know, flipped completely opposite. And we've got some very general nice rains through the Corn Belt. The heat is not necessarily here like they were talking about. I know distance forecast, I think yesterday afternoon, some people were maybe talking about heat coming back into the forecast, maybe the 15th or something like that. We'll have to see whether or not that materializes. And then we'll have to see whether or not the active rain system that we've had here, at least over the last couple of weeks or over the 3 week, the start of the 3 week pattern there around June 22nd or 3rd, we'll see whether or not that continues. But it's been basically pulling the plug on the drought. And now everybody's looking at crop rating levels and some pretty hefty yields. Corn, terrible, you know, chart wise, just basically ripped the chart to threads. It just went through a thread. And basically what did that was the acreage increase, when people were kind of looking for maybe a little smaller acres, and then USDA finding 200 million bushels that the trade didn't think was around. So that's highly suggestive that USDA is understating last year's production. And that is, you know, ultimately will probably, I don't know where they're going to put it at, but it'll probably end up in carryover. How they balance it out before they raise, whether or not USDA probably will not raise the production, but it does indicate that, because I do think we have enough livestock around to warrant the current feed use disappearance level, but they'll have to take it out of that to make the balance sheet work if they're going to use current production numbers.
The little rally the corn staged this morning, I take it probably came out of Brazil when CONAB said that the crop was 7 million metric tons smaller than they even expected. That would be the total crop, first and second crop corn. However, corn, in the face of 50-cent losses in the soybeans, even wheat maintained a pretty decent day. That's got to be a decent sign, I would think.
Oh, I think so. I think the corn is going to stabilize here because the open interest has been pretty well taken back to where it was here. Last fall, I think. So, I do think the speculative positions in corn have been pretty well taken out of it, and I do think demand is better than what the trade is talking about, but right now the trade is focused on supply. I think the best good to excellent rating level we've had in corn. So people are penciling in, you know, at least what USDA indicates on trend line yield, if not penciling in a little larger yield. You know, I remember one of the interviews you had with Daryl, I think, last week. I mean, crop rating levels at this stage of the growing season are basically based upon color. And the next phase of crop rating levels will be, you know, how the pollination went, the size of ears. And we still have a long ways to grow a crop. But Yes, I mean, everything that I've seen, I'm back up in Illinois. So I came up through northwest Missouri and Quincy, western Illinois, up through Macomb and Monmouth and on to the Quad Cities. And the crops looked good then before the rain. So here on the home farm, it looks excellent up in this area. So there's no doubt that we got a big crop coming for what we see today. But August weather is still very critical. I've seen good crops deteriorate in August. August has a tendency to have a lot of heat in it. August has a tendency, if you don't get an active hurricane season in the Gulf and all the hurricanes is maybe in the Atlantic Ocean, has a tendency to be dry. So there's been a lot of crops yield has been taken out of it during the month of August, and we'll just have to see how the summer plays out on that one.
Dan, thanks so much, and good luck to you and your father up there, okay?
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with Zwicker Consulting from Waco, Texas. In today's agricultural news, the U.S. Senate yesterday afternoon approved a procedural vote on GMO labeling, setting up a possible final vote later today. The Senate voted 65-32 to limit the debate on the bill. The vote was briefly interrupted by protesters throwing money and yelling, "You've been bribed by Monsanto." Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada voted against the bill, arguing that senators should have had the opportunity to offer amendments. The bill, known as the Roberts-Stabenow Compromise, preempts state laws requiring labeling of genetically modified foods and establishes a federal mandatory disclosure system. Speaking of state laws, a recent online survey found Vermont's newly implemented GMO labeling law strongly misleads consumers. The survey, sponsored by the American Soybean Association, asked more than 1,600 shoppers regarding their understanding of five common on-pack food labels. When consumers were asked about the GMO label statements mandated by the Vermont law, the survey showed that on-pack labeling misled consumers to wrongly perceive the labeled product as less safe, less healthful, less nutritious, and worse for the environment. Approximately 73% of consumers responding to the survey indicated they would be less likely to buy foods bearing one of the required on-pack GMO label disclosures. Well, let's stay in Washington, D.C., where the U.S. House Republicans have announced a framework on comprehensive tax reform. House Republicans plan to reform the tax code and would make significant changes for businesses and lower tax rates. The American Farm Bureau Federation tax specialist Pat Wolf calls the plan a bold new approach that would benefit farmers.
The immediate deduction of all business inputs, so that would be equipment and buildings and animals, is something that farmers have asked for a long time, and it's a very positive part of this plan.
Farmers face many uncertainties, of course, including hard-to-predict weather and market changes. However, Wolf says this plan would eliminate uncertainty in the tax code.
This proposal is a encompassing, long-term, permanent change to the tax code. Farmers would know for sure how certain business decisions would impact their bottom line.
That's Pat Wolf, a tax specialist with the American Farm Bureau Federation. And finally today, let's move from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. China is one of the United States' most rapidly growing markets for hay, increasing 500% over the last 5 years. Steve Norberg, a regional forage specialist with Washington State University, explains.
We exported 1.13 million tons in 2015 to China, and the tons of hay exported to China grew by 24% over that was exported in 2014. And it continues to grow amazingly, even with the GMO challenges, a strong dollar, and pork slowdowns that we experienced some of last year.
That's Steve Norberg of Washington State University. He says most of the hay exported to China is alfalfa for the dairy market. He says China has surpassed Japan today for alfalfa exported. He adds that China is pickier than Japan when it comes to GMO issues. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Have you been to your local county fair this year? There's a pretty good chance that's the case. Did you know in Illinois, the county fairs create about $170 million worth of economic activity? These agricultural celebrations are moneymakers, knitted tightly into the fabric of rural America and its economy. Community and economic development crew at the University of Illinois surveyed fairgoers to get an idea of just how much money they spend and why they go.
Give that ticket to the gentleman right over here.
Entertainment, of course, is high on the list, says Zach Kennedy.
We also found that they were there for anything ranging from doing activities, seeing exhibits. Some folks were there just for the food.
And those folks spend a lot of money. The biggest spenders live in southern Illinois, averaging some $200 a person for the run of the fair. The Northern Illinois fairs, not to be outdone, bring in the most money, almost $100 million. But really, to be honest, going to the fair, well, it's not so much about the money.
The ideas of tradition and unity and educational opportunities rose to the top of some of the things that folks said that the fair meant to them and their family.
The traditions are deep in the social fabric. It's colored with the 4-H clover. The county fair is a time to work hard and play hard with neighbors and friends, and to share those experiences with others. Along the way, in the state of Illinois, the county fairs create 1,000 jobs and something approaching a couple $100 million. Let's take a look at the cash grain market now. Matt Bennett is here from Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds in Windsor, Illinois. Thanks, Matt, for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Did you get rain the last week?
Yes, we have. We've fortunately, our crops look a lot better and our prospects look a little bit better than what they did a week ago. Since we talked last, we've had, anywhere from 2 to 3.5 inches in the last week. So we've gotten along pretty good. And most of it's come right, so I can't complain about that.
Yeah, I was thinking here we've gotten, I don't quite know, probably close to that much on the farm over in near Springfield, only 9/10 in the last week, and it's still running behind, but this is a good time to get 9/10 of an inch. So I suspect things look way better this week than they have. However, the prices have dropped dramatically. What are you telling farmers about that?
Yeah, you know, as you know, we've been very heavily hedged on soybeans, and we feel really good about where we're at there, regardless of what happens. We've got cash sales on 40%, and then the rest of our beans that we're expecting to produce would push underneath them at awfully favorable prices. As far as corn goes, we weren't near as aggressive, so at this point, I really don't want to sell below cost of production. You know, I've got guys telling me that even if I have 240 bushel corn, I can't make money. So I'm not sure I'm going to get real aggressive right now. I kind of want to wait and see if we get through pollination and grain fill with good weather. And if that's the case, then we may be looking at storing some corn this year.
And for soybeans?
Soybeans, I'm standing pat right now. But I will say that if a person can definitely justify profitability, which they still should be able to do so, albeit not as much as what we had before, I don't have any problem at all with making sales on soybeans or protecting price.
All right. And then as you look forward, what do you think will happen in the next month? What's the next big thing for you?
Well, the thing is we just got to see what the weather's going to do, and that's obviously the wild card. We've still got people out there saying it's going to get extremely hot and dry, but whether that ever comes to pass or not, that's the big question. So I think moving ahead, people have to be ready for these wild gyrations. When you see the markets yesterday down 35 cents and then unchanged by the close, I mean, that's some crazy volatility. People have to have offers in place, know what their profit margins are, and try to lock them in if they get a chance to.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Matt Bennett is with Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds in Windsor, Illinois. Let's turn our attention to the weather forecast. Now we're joined by Mike Tenurum. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. Thanks for being with us. As we heard from Matt, we've had some rainfall over the past week. What's your assessment of that? And as we look forward, Mike?
Well, we have seen quite a bit of rainfall in a lot of different areas over the last several days. This is all part of a weather pattern that we call the Ring of Fire. The reason we call it that is because we have a lot of hot air to the south of the Corn Belt that is trying to move north. But at the exact same time, we have separately waves of energy moving across the northern U.S. and southern Canada. When the heat and the storm systems interact, that's what leads to these big thunderstorm clusters that we've seen over the last couple of days. Now, the big question, of course, is, Is this pattern going to continue? Well, in some fashion, the answer is clearly yes. We're going to see more thunderstorm clusters throughout the Corn Belt over the next 7 to 10 days. The exact timing and location of thunderstorms at any point in time is very difficult to assess. Even coming up tonight and into tomorrow, we're not exactly sure where the next thunderstorm cluster will form, and that's simply a function of the rain that we've had over the last 12 hours or so. There has been fairly extensive cloudiness across the Corn Belt this morning, and until all of that erodes away, and we can see exactly where the little boundaries are all lying, now we won't really know exactly what's going to happen tonight. But more than likely, we'll see another thunderstorm cluster somewhere from the Dakotas through Minnesota, maybe into parts of Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. That's kind of the main focal area for tonight. But again, you know, we just need to kind of keep an eye on the radar later and see how everything comes together. And we'll see more of this going forward. We do cool off here for a few days this weekend, but that only occurs for a couple of days. After that, we're going to see another strong system move across the northern plains. And what that will do is make for another area of thunderstorms early next week, but with the extra caveat that it will turn much hotter as we go into next week too. So we generally think that this ring of fire pattern will last for about 7 to 10 more days. And again, that pretty much means we'll see occasional periods of heat, occasional thunderstorms in different areas at different times, but generally warmer than normal and wetter than normal leading into next weekend.
I think the big concern is how high the temperatures might be. Above 93 would be a problem for pollination. And Nick, it sounds like if we get through the next 7 days, we're probably not quite that high. But what about after that?
Once we get into next week, and that's where things get a little bit trickier, there's several hints that suggest that this upper-level high that is driving the hot weather that we're seeing bubbling around the U.S. now is going to shift a little bit further to the north. And as long as it does that, more than likely what will end up happening is we'll see several days of fairly widespread heat starting up around next Sunday or Monday. That will be July 17th and 18th. Whether or not that ultimately leads to a drier pattern and a hotter pattern through the end of the month, or if it simply just sets the stage for another round of thunderstorms a few days after heat begins, are some pretty big and pretty important questions. We just don't have the answers, and we don't expect to have the answers to that one for at least 3 or 4 days, and probably not for 5 or 6 days.
Mike Tenura is with T-Storm Weather. He is out of Chicago. That's the closing market report for this 7th day of July.